From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Pentagon is at a crossroads. This is the era of sequestration, of budget battles in Washington, but also of incredible surges in war technology, from robots to cyber warfare, by America's allies and potential adversaries. Our second long, costly post-9/11 war is almost behind us. So the Pentagon is mapping out a new military future. Get ready for a huge brawl between the Pentagon brass, Congress, the contractors, and more. This hour, On Point, downsizing, changing the U.S. military and what it means for America's defense. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it time to downsize? Time to reshape the U.S. military? How and by how much? With what implications? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel yesterday talking about, well, what it's going to take to get to the changes we need now, he says.
This is a time for reality. This is a budget that recognizes the reality of the magnitude of our fiscal challenges, the dangerous world we live in, and the American military's unique and indispensable role in the security of this country and in today's volatile world. There are difficult decisions ahead. That is the reality we're living.
Difficult decisions and reality, says the Secretary of Defense. Joining us first today from Washington is Diane Nissenbaum, national security reporter based in Washington for the Wall Street Journal. Diane, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. What's driving this move on Chuck Hagel's part?
Well, it's really, as you said, it's the end of the ground wars in Afghanistan and before that, Iraq, where we really are at a pivot point here where we are deciding we're not going to try and fight any more land wars, and we need to shift our focus towards emerging concerns, primarily in Asia.
Does this mean a change in spending? There's been a lot of talk in the headlines about pre-World War II. I guess what that really points to is U.S. Army troop strength being the lowest it's been since then. Of course, before World War II, it was only 230,000-240,000. Even with this, it would be 400,000 plus. What about the numbers, and is it a change in percentage of GDP spending on the military or just in troop strength?
Well, there's a lot of different ways, obviously, to sort of look at the budget, and a lot of that will depend on what happens in Washington with these automatic spending cuts that people in Washington call sequestration. If you look at the budget for the Pentagon, it's essentially going to hold flat for now. And if the sequestration goes forward, it could mean real significant cuts. And that's one of the big concerns going forward is they've been able to sort of ward this off for now, but the political deadlock in Congress means that we don't have a long-term solution for avoiding these across-the-board spending cuts going forward. And one of the things that Secretary Hagel was saying yesterday is, look, this budget that we're proposing is taking cuts and dealing with reductions that we need to make, but it could be even worse if Congress doesn't deal with these other problems in the coming years ahead.
So, Diane, let's walk across the horizon of what this would mean. Take Army troop strength first. What has that been? What would it be under the cuts that Secretary Hagel's proposing?
So it was at a peak of about 570,000. It's right now at about 520,000, and the proposal could take it now as low as 440,000. Now that takes you back, as you said, to what it was when the U.S. was about to enter World War II. Obviously, that's still a very large number. It could go down to 420,000 if the sequestration cuts take effect. What the Army says is they really need to have at least 450,000 to make sure that they can defend the country. So we're kind of at that crux there where the Army is saying we can go to 450, but if we go lower than that, then it's a real significant risk.
Now, to put this in context, I mean, at the super peak of World War II, it was 6 million. Peak of Korean War, 1.6 million. Peak of Vietnam War, 1.6 million. As you say, post 9/11, up above 500,000, well above. But it's been down in the 400,000-500,000 range for a couple of decades now.
Yeah, and this is basically the policy question that we need going forward. The Secretary Hagel said we're not planning to fight any ground wars. And I think the challenge here, as everybody says, and maybe your guest later will say as well, is that we are always preparing for the last war. We don't really know what war is coming down the pike. On September 10th, 2001, who knew what was ahead for the next 13 years? Right now, Secretary Hagel is saying, look, we've got to look to the future, and the future seems to be in China. There are emerging concerns in the Asia-Pacific. There are concerns in Africa with Al-Qaeda militants. Maybe we need to put more money into special forces, the kind of the lean, mean fighting machines that killed Osama bin Laden and have rescued Captain Phillips in the famous movie. So that's where they're putting the focus going forward, and whether that's the right strategy is really what people are going to be debating.
Talk to us about other cuts in terms of equipment or programs. What else would this budget put on the under the axe?
Well, the Army, again, takes a big hit. They're canceling a plan to create a new armored troop carrier. The Navy took a pretty big hit that with their future ship known as the Littoral Combat Ship. They wanted to build more than 50 of those, and there's been a lot of concerns about whether that ship, which is sort of a light combat vehicle that's designed to sort of combat pirates and small threats on the sea and along the coast. They've canceled that. They're only going to do about 30 of them now, and they're going to try and develop a different kind of ship that can deal with larger threats. Those were two of the big ones. The Air Force is getting hit with a cancellation of the plane known as the A-10 Warthog, which is cherished by the Air Force and a lot of troops because it's used to protect soldiers in battle.
It was designed to stop Soviet tanks coming across Eastern Europe in the old Cold War scenario.
Exactly, yes. And in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was used to help soldiers on the ground. Mm-hmm. The F-35, the most expensive program in history, the new fighter jet, seems to be protected. And I think that's going to raise a lot of questions as well about whether we're spending too much on that program and sacrificing others.
What about spending on personnel?
Yeah, it's a big area. It's always very difficult to deal with. Secretary Hagel is trying to essentially raise some health care fees and reduce some support for base grocery stores. They are freezing the pay of generals and top officers for a year. The pay raises are going to be higher, but not as high as the cost of living. So they're trying to push this through, but those are already facing resistance from veterans groups and lawmakers who are arguing that this is trying to balance the budget on the backs of the people that are on the front lines.
Are there areas in terms of warfighting strategy or targeted missions where spending would be increased, Diane?
There are a few areas. As I mentioned before, special operations forces are going to increase their numbers by about 5% to about 69,000 total, which is still fairly small. You know, again, these are the people that went in to kill Osama bin Laden and have rescued Americans in Somalia where they've been kidnapped mm-hmm. and things like that. They also are going to try and put a little more emphasis in creating cyber warriors to try and deal with cyber threats. And that's an area where we expect to see more focus in the years ahead.
We heard for years that the Pentagon's goal was to be ready to fight two major wars at once. Now, maybe that we've backed off. Where does that stand? Did we back off of that already? Was it one plus? And where would this leave the country?
Yeah, we're essentially at a one plus now, and we're shifting towards a one, I would say. And this is part of the broader debate that's playing out in Washington here is whether we need to be able to fight two wars at the same time. And Secretary Hagel yesterday was essentially saying, look, we're not even going to prepare to fight major ground wars going forward. We need to shift our strategy and become more nimble and adept and focus on leaner, meaner forces.
In other words, not even one major ground war in these numbers?
Well, then, to be clear, we certainly are prepared to do it. The focus here is on other efforts. So the 450 is certainly going to be able to do that. But the hope going forward is that is not where we're headed.
We're going to hear some debate on these plans and numbers in just a moment. Where do you see this headed in terms of acceptance or pushback in Washington, Diane?
Well, there were a number of analysts last week and this week saying that a lot of this is essentially DOA because we are in an election year, and few people that are up for re-election are going to want to be seen as doing anything that's seen as cutting support for our military and especially for our troops. So it's going to be difficult to get a lot of this through Congress this year. On the compensation front, there's a special commission that's set up that's going to look at this and make recommendations next year, so people will kick it till next year. Nobody wants to look at closing bases in their districts. I think there's going to be a lot of resistance to virtually every major element of this budget plan.
But aren't there cutbacks built into the sequestration path of the budget?
Well, then this is the challenge, and this is what Secretary Hagel and General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were saying yesterday, is they've essentially agreed on a deal that staves that off for the short term, but it is in the immediate future, and these cuts don't even take into account the deeper automatic across-the-board cuts that could hit if Congress and the White House can't work out an agreement. And that's the real, you know, 800-pound gorilla in the room here, is that even the stuff that we're talking about now doesn't factor in some of the deeper automatic cuts that will hit in 2016.
Diane Nissenbaum with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for joining us from Washington today, Diane.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's call to downsize the U.S. military in a time of lean budget and budgets, and what that means for American forces, American defense. You can look at the fever line of U.S. Army troop strength just for one. It's gone up and down over the years. Chuck Hagel saying, let's take it down to the lowest point since before World War II. Here's a little sound of the huge buildup that came then after Japan struck Pearl Harbor. Different army, very different mission.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on six continents to save the homes and ideals of free men from Axis domination.
There we go. As it went to 6 million in World War II. Flash forward, 2014, the Defense Secretary talking about a different time. Here he was yesterday talking about working for lower budgets.
The development and proliferation of more advanced military technologies by other nations, that means that we are entering an era where American dominance on the seas, in the skies, and in space can no longer be taken for granted.
Dominance can't be taken for granted. Limitless budgets can't be taken for granted. What would Secretary Hagel like to do? Here he is.
We chose further reductions in troop strength and force structure in every military service, active and reserve, in order to sustain our readiness and technological superiority, and to protect critical capabilities like special operations forces and cyber resource.
New day. There is pushback already in Washington. Cuts in military spending are always politically fraught, and of course this is too. Let's look at what's going on with a couple of guests right here. Russell Rumbaugh joins us from Washington, Director for Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Programs at the Stimson Center, former defense analyst at the Defense Department and the CIA. Russell Rumbaugh, thank you for joining us today. Welcome to On Point.
And thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Daniel Garay joins us, Vice President at the Lexington Institute, national security think tank there, former Director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Daniel Garay, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Russell Rumbaugh, first to you. What do you make of what the Defense Secretary is putting forward here?
Well, I think the most important context we need to remember is that this is the latest round in the broader debates about how much the government's going to spend in general. It seemed like there was a deal cut by Congress last December in the Murray-Ryan Budget Act that undid some of sequester, but left sequester as law of the land. Here's the first budget we've had in 3 years that is actually trying to plan and program for those levels. That's $30 billion less than what FY12, now 3 years ago, was being considered. That's a really important context, and that's why we're seeing such dramatic changes, or what seem like such dramatic changes, because this is the first time we've seen the Pentagon's plan and program for this level.
Yeah, but let's back up, because when the sequestration was put into place, the whole idea of it was that this was
These were dumb cuts, and they were cuts that the country, the Republican Party in particular, would never accept for the Pentagon. And now you've got the Defense Secretary accepting them to some extent and redrawing the U.S. military on the basis of those budgetary limits. So my question to you is, what do you think of the redrawing that he's doing, and does it leave the United States well defended?
Well, I think the most important part of that is these dumb cuts that the Republicans would never accept was clearly not true. In fact, it's right. The Republicans in Congress who have been willing to accept it. They weren't willing to accept all the way down, right? Certainly, Representative Ryan led the negotiations last fall that culminated in the December deal. So it wasn't quite all the way down, although not this year, but next year in FY16, we'll get to basically the same low point in terms of real dollars. But that said, we're still spending $500 billion in defense. We haven't even talked about the nuclear budget. And we're still, although the U.S. has now fallen somewhat below 50% of world spending, to suggest that the U.S. is now a vulnerable and laid exposed is dramatic hyperbole.
I'm not. I'm asking you what you make of the changes that he's describing here. In defense terms, where does it leave the United States?
It leaves the United States as the richest and most powerful nation on earth.
In defense terms, in military strength terms and deployment terms.
In military strength, the U.S. will have more carriers, more tanks, more advanced fighters. The U.S. is still, and by large margin, the most strong military on earth. We've just seen that recently. Our most advanced allies, the Europeans, have undertaken a couple adventures. France went into Mali, what we saw in the Libya operation 2 years ago. These are the most advanced militaries in the world outside of the United States. And at the end of the day, they came to the U.S. and asked for help and support. Please provide us the awareness that those advanced capabilities that tell us where things are, the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities. Please provide us more munitions to fire. The U.S. remains the dominant country militarily and in defense terms.
At his announcement yesterday, press conference yesterday, here's the defense secretary saying these are cuts, but we can still take care of business that needs taking care of. Chuck Hagel.
The forces we prioritize can project power over great distances and carry out a variety of missions more relevant to the president's defense strategy, such as homeland defense, strategic deterrence, building partnership capacity, and defeating asymmetric threats. They are also well-suited to the strategy's rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region, to sustaining security commitments in the Middle East and Europe, and our engagement in other regions.
Daniel Garay, join us here. There we are. We're covered on homeland defense, strategic deterrence, partnership capacity, defeating asymmetric threats. It sounds like we're fine with these cuts, with these changes, Daniel, according to the defense secretary.
Well, I don't happen to agree, but even if he's right about this for the moment, take a snapshot, because this isn't the end. And therefore, as Russell was suggesting, when we go through the future cuts, this will not be a military that is capable of doing all the things the secretary says we can now do.
Beyond the cuts he's describing, you're saying there's more coming?
He himself has said there's more coming, that this is only – what he has proposed here is only doable, and even then I might doubt it, if he gets all the internal changes, a change to military compensation, base closure, billions of dollars in reductions there, cuts in headquarters personnel, cuts in the National Guard and Reserve Forces. It's only doable if, in fact, sequestration is essentially over. By whatever means, the president is going to propose a growth and opportunity and security fund of over $50 billion a year, half of which will go to defense and half of which will go to domestic programs. This is his way of trying to get out from under sequestration. Without that, remember, Hagel said the army will go down from the planned 450 to 420, possibly even lower. Other programs will have to be terminated or cut back. Other forces will have to be cut back. Training will suffer more than it is already. Maintenance will suffer more than it is already. So I don't happen to think he's right, but even if he is, this may be the last moment in time that you see a U.S. military capable of doing the global mission that he says we need to do.
So here we've got, from that perspective, we've got Congress driving this with the sequestration cut requirements. And is this, Daniel Garay, then the Pentagon responding, saying, okay, if you're going to cut us, here's the best array for us to be situated in militarily in terms of forces and equipment and training and technology to deal with this smaller purse?
Absolutely. I think, look, overall, what the Secretary has proposed is not a bad set. They've spent now well over a year thinking their way through this. Because this is a military that still has to be what they call full spectrum. It has to do everything from the nuclear deterrence mission all the way down to Homeland Security, chasing after bin Laden, and everything in between. Mm-hmm. It has to take care of its veterans. It has to develop the technologies for the future. And so, in a sense, it's juggling multiple chainsaws all at the same time. And this is about the – this is not bad considering, but everything takes a cut. And the way I like to say it is, it's increased risk. What that really means is if we're not real careful, we could get schwacked somewhere. It will mean more casualties. You could lose a conflict over this, even at the levels he's proposing.
There was talk of risk at the same time here, both from the Defense Secretary and a little earlier in the week from General Martin Dempsey. Here was Chuck Hagel again at his press conference yesterday saying there's greater risk, but he said manageable risk with this defense profile.
While this smaller capacity entails some additional risks, even if we execute extended or simultaneous ground operations, our analysis showed that this force would be capable of decisively defeating aggression in one major combat theater, as it must be, while also defending the homeland and supporting air and naval forces engaged in another theater against an adversary.
And Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, saying looking forward to more sequestration cuts, and again, talking risk. Here's the general.
To be clear, we do assume higher risks in some area. In some areas under the FY15 budget, and we'll have to manage those risks. However, if sequestration level cuts return in 16, the risks grow and the options we can provide the nation dramatically shrink.
Daniel Garay, there's the Defense Secretary first saying we can still fulfill the mission of one major combat theater plus action against another adversary, one plus. Do you see that in the force structure and troop levels described yesterday, that capacity?
Oh, frankly, it's possible, but really only if the adversaries choose to play the game in a way that benefits us. So if I have a North Korea that decides to invade the South and simultaneously Iran that tries to cross the Persian Gulf, or goes into Iraq, for example, to seize the oil there. No, we don't have that. So the hope here is that we will have maybe only at the same time one big war, whatever that means, with ground forces and air forces and naval forces, and one that is smaller or characterologically constrained in some way to the air or the sea, so that our forces can kind of operate the way we would like to our benefit. That's asking a lot of our adversaries.
Russell Rimbaugh, how do you see it? In the new configuration, as outlined by Secretary Hagel, could the U.S. handle one big war plus a second conflict?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is disaggregate what we mean by war. When you say war, do you mean the Iraq War? Do you mean World War II? Do you mean Korea? And when you mean Korea, do you mean the first year of significant ups and downs of the peninsula, or do you mean the last 2 years where we sat in a stalemated battlefield around the same line our troops and the North Koreans are staring at each other across 60 years later? So this idea that we can abstract out war and make this a mathematical model of what's 1, 1.2, 2, 3, that's a little bit of a misnomer. The U.S. can launch a strike anywhere in the world, anywhere. There is no geographic location the United States could not strike in a matter of hours. That's incredibly responsive. Even when we get down to the 450,000, the Army is still planning on maintaining 33 brigades. To give you a sense of that, in the opening phases of the Iraq War in 2003, March 2003, it was 8 brigades. And oh, by the way, that wasn't just the Army, that also included the Marines. So this concept, this idea that there's just a standardized war we can look at, the U.S. military has unbelievable power. Now, Is there risk? Absolutely. Maybe Secretary Gates best said this himself when being questioned by a member of
Congress. Bob Gates, Secretary under George Bush and then later Barack Obama, who himself called for cuts in spending.
Although he might take issue with that. He was very proud about calling for cuts in how the defense budget did business. But facing a skeptical member of Congress who said, tell me how much money it takes to guarantee the U.S.'s safety. And Secretary Gates tries to demur. He tries to say, you know, that's not a real question. And the member comes back and says, no, I insist. And Secretary Gates finally relents and says, look, there is no end to the number of requirements that can be asked of the military. You cannot get rid of all risk. He said, even if we had $1 trillion, twice what we spend on the Defense Department, twice what we have ever spent on the Defense Department in the last since World War II, he could not guarantee you would wring out all risk. That is something we live with. And when you hear the secretary or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, they're talking about relative risk, whereas we have the luxury in this conversation about talking about the absolute risk.
Daniel Garay, what about this view? Look, it's not about abstract characterizations of what it would take to fight one big war. We can strike anywhere. We can strike fast. So that's not a bad start, and we've still got 33 brigades in the U.S. Army.
Well, if airstrikes alone would do it, we would have won Vietnam. We would have won all these wars that we didn't. We would have won Afghanistan. It's not that simple either. And that, in fact, when you start to look at prospective adversaries, whether it's Iran, North Korea, God forbid, China, the kind of forces that one may require, is likely to require, is going to be significantly greater than can be applied in a single strike.
But does any country ever stay on the kind of military strength footing that would permit a superpower like the United States to go to war with a huge country like China? Nobody can perpetually be in that readiness.
Really? We did it for over 50 years with the Soviet Union. You can. And in fact, at the worst, we were spending about 6% of gross national product. We're now at just below 4%. You could spend 4% of GDP, which is about what it takes for the military we're talking about here, without the Hegel cuts. I would argue to you ad infinitum. That is not a huge insurance policy or a huge bill, given how much money this country generates, what its GDP tends to be.
Russell, would you bring it down below 4% if that's where we are now of GDP?
Well, you've always got a problem when you're using GDP. The biggest problem with the measure of GDP, of using percentage of GDP, is the United States is a very rich country. Now, unfortunately, many Americans right now don't feel like they're rich. But we are richer than we were in the 50s. So although we're spending less as a percentage of GDP, in absolute terms, using constant dollars, making a fair comparison, we're actually going to spend more wildly. Even at what we're now calling the sequester levels of spending, compared to the dips we reached in the 50s, when the Soviet Union had just added a nuclear bomb, when China had just added a nuclear bomb, when we were facing challenges all around the world, or in the 70s, when the Soviet Union was dramatically expanding its navy, we are going to spend 25% more on defense today than we were in those times.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's call to downsize the U.S. military in a time of lean budgets and what that means for American forces, American defense, the rest of American society. Russell Rumbaugh is with us from the Stimson Center, Director for Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense there. Daniel Garay is with us from the Lexington Institute, Vice President there in Washington. Daniel, Russell, let's bring our listeners in. Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a former veteran, and during Iraq and Afghanistan, the amount of money we had to spend in our budgets was obscene. I mean, just you couldn't believe the amount of waste you would see. I think it's a good thing to trim things down a bit for the future. I think it had to happen sooner or later. It's good it's happening now.
Do you see risk there? Or it sounds like you're saying your direct observation was money to spare.
I the main risk comes from when everyone's talking about how we may not be ready to fight the next war. I keep going back to when I think it was General Shinseki said that it would take so many troops to win Iraq, and then he was just kind of, everyone kind of ignored him. I don't think it's money you need as much as the lack of manpower. And I think after Iraq and Afghanistan, you're going to have a huge lack of manpower, even if you have a huge budget.
A huge lack of manpower, even with a huge budget? You felt understaffed?
You're going to have a lack of manpower. I don't think a lot of people are going to... I think if another war comes up, I think you're going to see a very fatigued volunteer military. I don't think you're going to see a lot of people signing up for it. I worked recruiting in the aftermath of 9/11. I did not see a spike in people just coming to sign up with me. So I don't think the risk is we don't have enough money when it comes around. I think the risk is going to be we're going to have a population that's just not ready for another war.
And maybe in some respects, maybe they've had enough. But I know what you mean, Paul. Most people aren't exactly lining up for that. They got other things on their mind. Maybe they should. I appreciate your call. James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the military in 83, and that was under the Cold War period, and I also fought in Afghanistan and Iraq and also in the Horn of Africa with special operations. And I can tell you right now, the dynamic changes on the battlefield, you cannot put your blinders on, which is the Secretary of Defense and the President are doing, and thinking you can prepare for a future war. You have to be prepared for all aspects. Since World War II, we have yet to win a real war because we have been unprepared. And look how long it took technology and special operation forces to find Bin Laden, who had to get a blood transfusion almost every day. So technology and special operations is not the answer. And China has a million-plus man army. Russia has no qualms about being very forceful on the battlefield. And if you think technology and special operations are going to wipe out a million-man army, you have to have the force to stand toe-to-toe with them. And 420,000 is not going to beat a million, even if we have the technology to back it up.
James, we're making cuts all over. Should the military be exempt from those cuts?
Not necessarily. I don't think exempt. I think that, like your one caller said, we need to tighten down on waste and abuse of the funds and focus the funds. But you have to develop technology, and you have to get the manpower. You know, you can't go to war and just call up a whole bunch of recruits and say you're ready for war. It takes time to train them and the experience to win a war. World War II, we were lucky, it was a toe-to-toe battle, and that's the way Americans were growing up, you know, kind of rough and tumble kind of guys. Nowadays, you can't get people off the couches and do a toe-to-toe fight with another country because the people aren't prepared for that kind of war. And when you go into that war ill-prepared, and the dynamic, the speed of battle on the war nowadays, other countries have the technologies we have. So if we send a technology over to initiate or to fight or defend the war, they have the same technologies to kick us back too. And if we're not prepared on the ground, you cannot fight, you cannot win a war until you put boots on the ground.
James, we've got it. And I appreciate your call. Let us pick it up right there. Russell Rumbaugh, how about it? Sooner or later, everybody's going to have a whole lot of technology. So the argument from our caller, James, is it comes down to, you know, the men and women you can put in the field. And he sees American men and women on the couches these days, not in from the farm. What about that argument, Russell?
Well, I completely agree with James that our $500 billion defense budget is not enough to invade China. I think yes, he's absolutely yes. Right about that.
And let's not.
Both of your callers made a great point, and it talks about some fundamental dynamics of today's U.S. military. We're entering this year the fifth decade of having an all-volunteer force. That is absolutely a crucial part of understanding the dynamics going on in the U.S. military. We are no longer paying people peanuts because we're telling them either come join the Army or go to jail. Instead, we are asking people to sacrifice and serve their country. And to do that, you need to reward them properly, and we need to. Some of the discussion Hagel, the secretary, made yesterday was talking about trimming back benefits, but really what we've seen over the last four decades is making sure we pay for these people correctly. the U.S. military has a basic problem of the only people who are going to serve in the U.S. military are Americans, the most expensive labor force you're going to get anywhere in the world.
And I saw these numbers. This is from the Wall Street Journal here, saying that after September 11th, average pay and benefits for U.S. active duty and reserve personnel went from $44,200 in 2001 up to $81,600 in 2013, a rise of 85%. I'm not sure most military, active duty military, feel like they had their pay almost doubled, but that's what the numbers show, Russell.
Well, and it's very important to talk about why that happened. That happened primarily because of a large expansion in the benefits provided. Now, let's talk about what those benefits were. The biggest benefit newly provided in the last decade was what's called TRICARE for Life. If you are a Medicare-eligible retiree, we have created a new program to cover the difference in cost between what Medicare covers and what the rest of your health care. Obviously, an important thing, something we need to do to take care of our veterans. But we're now talking about somebody who's already over the age of 65. We're not talking about the young men and women who are serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, who, because most of them won't retire, won't actually be eligible for that benefit. So those personnel costs are going up without getting the guys both Paul and James talked about who are actually going to be fighting the war, any war we get into.
Here's a couple of listeners online. Walk says, there's no debate. The military needs a serious dose of austerity. If the rest of the country is going to be subject to austerity and sequestration, we must force the military to get off its perpetual high hog. Alan says, best defense for the U.S. is investing in our future. Imagine with all those wasteful defense dollars, Alan writes, what they could buy. Better schools, universal preschool, mass transit. Tim in Springfield, Vermont. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My point is that if we were honest with ourselves, we can't fight the wars that we're preparing for. That our tanks are obsolete, our helicopters are obsolete, our carriers are obsolete. If we fought a war with Russia, China, or God forbid, a European power, and the only reason we fought the wars that we fought is because we could.
So where are you going, Tim? Do you welcome the changes that Chuck Hagel's outlining or not?
Well, yes, I do.
Why?
I think that we have to face what the reality is that the effects of a modern war without even using nuclear weapons would be just horrendous. And the weapons that we prepared for these wars are a carrier could be sunk within hours.
Yeah, Tim, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Daniel Garay, there's the perspective, and a lot of people share it these days, that this whole, structure of war, a bad way to go, doesn't make sense anymore. Destructive power is too great. All kinds of equipment at the bottom of the sea before you know it, not to mention internet infrastructure and all the rest. Let's just not go to war, Daniel.
Absolutely. I think that we ought to outlaw war. That's the best thing. And of course, we ought to outlaw 5,000 years of human history, which seem to suggest that wars do happen. In fact, even this administration, which was fairly anti-war, shall we call it, has managed to do its level best to get us, to keep us in several of them, took till 2014 to get us out of Afghanistan, has sent U.S. troops into the heart of Africa, has supported, as Russell was saying, a European operation against Libya, and had U.S. ships off the coast of Syria just last year ready to conduct military strikes. So this notion that somehow we can just walk away from the world, walk away from our interest, walk away from bad guys, and walk away from war is, can I say it, silly beyond belief.
Your outfit, Lexington Institute, gets no small part of its support from military contractors.
Absolutely.
So how are we supposed to factor that into your assessment of what's going on with our defense profile? Presumably, they've got programs here that might well be on the cutting block.
I'm sure they are on the cutting block. We don't defend all programs just because somebody gives us a donation, nor in many cases are we against programs when there isn't a donation. And by the way, I would just point out to you that a lot of think tanks get money that is from special interests.
It's
not
a jungle
all of them defense
out there.
It certainly is. And, you know, in fact, you can almost guarantee which group gives to which think tank by the political or philosophical slant of that think tank.
So here's my question to you. With all the vested interest in the spending, and the spending the way it's been done, do you think we can get – surely we need some kind of constant updating and reform of how we spend, where we put our resources. Can we get that done in a sensible way, facing the thicket of political and economic interests that are all around our military spending, Daniel?
We have in the past. We can again. But let me point out to you, the interesting area that Hagel didn't mention, nobody particularly has, is reforming the way the Department of Defense buys stuff. We've done studies at Lexington that suggest that over 20% of what is spent at the Department of Defense on non-personnel stuff is because of regulations, special ways of having to account for things, price controls, you name it. If you simply reformed the acquisition system, you might actually find enough savings to pay for all the stuff that Hagel is having to take out or to compensate for any sequestration. But you'll notice he didn't talk about doing that. He just talked about cutting systems.
Russell Rumbaugh, when you look at Secretary Hagel's proposal, do you see the best analysis at work here, best planning, most rational planning for a future which, as he points out, has some resource constraints in it?
I think you see, most importantly, the big decision made in 2012 that we are no longer going to size to stability operations.
What does that mean? Does that mean nation building, occupying countries? Is that what you mean?
Something like that. What we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan, something where we're not just going to strike an enemy and leave, but we're going to stay there and we're going to have to rotate our troops through there. That absolutely, obviously, as Dan cataloged very well, we are fortunate enough to be Americans that we've rarely gone looking for a fight, yet we keep finding one. And it turns out that fight frequently is uglier than we want it to be and requires us staying longer than we want. This defense budget says we've got to start avoiding that. Now, to the president's credit, despite all of the military action he's taken, none of it has incurred greater staying. So there is not just a logic in it, a strategy explicitly stated in the Defense Strategic Guidance in 2012. We can now look at a few years of evidence of it. And finally, now we're getting this defense budget, which is not going to have the size of an army that could go and stay year in and year out, whether that be in Afghanistan or Iraq or yet another place, but at the same time is putting resources in. The plane the Air Force is cutting is the 40-year-old interdiction plane, the one that's doing the close fight.
You're talking the A-10, the Warthog.
That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It's protecting the fighters and maybe in this case, most importantly, the bomber that's going to fly around the world and strike places. So there's a huge judgment being made here. We are no longer going to size to conduct these stability operations. And, of course, it'll be interesting how many of your listeners agree with that basic judgment in this budget.
Do you see the possibility here that we are at a tipping point where the technologies become strong enough that we don't have to have as big a boots-on-the-ground force? That technology plus special forces can play a much bigger role that would offset the need for, I don't know, 100,000, 200,000 troops?
We've certainly seen some offset. All of the Army's leaders, all of our military leaders have applauded what the all-volunteer force has achieved in the last 10 years. And I think most people would acknowledge that's because we have a professional force, not just guys who got dragged off the street, but people who have volunteered to serve, are given the training, and are given the experience to get good at it. Clearly, that is compensated for some amount of numbers. At the same time, we're also stuck on a spectrum of how does the use of military force achieve your political problems? And Dan's already given us a few examples of that. The kind of problems we're trying to solve, although I believe we're all in jest, if your goal is to topple the regime in China, I don't think that's going to happen with some airstrikes or Tomahawk missiles. At the same time, I don't want to think about the force it would take to go in and occupy Beijing.
Let's not make that a goal. Daniel Gray, would you like to make the argument for Hegel's proposal here before Congress? Could you go to bat for it?
I suppose I could go to bat in the following sense, which is it's the probably about as good as you can do given the bad situation you have been put in. That is, he hasn't been allowed to say, okay, we won't do Europe. We won't do...
i.e. we won't stay there defending
We
Europe.
Won't stay there. We won't go to the Middle East if there's a war there. We don't care if Taiwan is attacked by China. We won't do any of those things. He hasn't been given any of those choices, so he's got to take that force and spread it like peanut butter over 10 different slices of bread, the major mission areas, and that's really tough.
Bear all that in mind as you hear the debate that will surely be very vigorous over the coming weeks around the Pentagon's proposal and U.S. budget realities. I thank my guest today, Daniel Gray, at the Lexington Institute in Washington. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Russell Rumbaugh at the Stimson Center, Director for Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and the Defense Program there. Russell Rumbaugh, thank you for joining us today.
And thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.